Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
And welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, President Uhuru Kenyatta appears before the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where he faces crimes against humanity charges. The prosecution accuses him of delaying the proceedings by refusing to cooperate with a request for financial and other statements.
The delay in this case is non-compliance with the revised records request. That non-compliance is not due to any action of the prosecution. It's not due to any action of your honours. It's due exclusively to action of the government of Kenya, which is under the total control of this accused.
The defence says the case should be thrown out.
He is entitled to his verdict of not guilty because this case has not been brought. There are no further inquiries going on.
Also on the programme, infertility in Nigeria and Grace Mugabe's entry into Zimbabwean politics. Stay tuned.
Top story.
Lawyers for Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, have asked judges at the International Criminal Court to drop the Crimes Against Humanity case against him, saying the prosecution has collapsed and cannot be resurrected. Prosecutors have acknowledged that they do not currently have enough evidence to prosecute Kenyatta for his alleged role in instigating and funding violence that left more than 1,000 people dead and forced 600,000 from their homes in the aftermath of Kenya's 2007 presidential elections. Rights campaigners such as Elizabeth Evanson from Human Rights Watch fear there could be serious consequences if the case against Kenyatta falls apart.
If the case is unable to go forward, and it seems like everyone agrees that for now it can't go forward to trial as it stands, I mean, I think that that does would have the effect of setting back efforts to end a culture of impunity in Kenya.
Our correspondent, Catherine Martin, was in court at the ICC in The Hague, and I asked her to take us through the day's proceedings.
First of all, it was to gather really information and to get out of this kind of deadlock between the prosecution and, on the other side, the defence. Because what we really see in court today is that the prosecution still has the position that there is enough evidence to get to trial, but only they don't have access to the elements. And the defense says we provided the court with everything we had. We complied fully with our obligations. And for the judges, this today was just a key moment to get all the information from both sides. And now, in this light, to be able to take really a final decision, is this case really to be filed or not?
What was the mood like in court?
Kenyatta seemed very self-confident. Even before the hearing, he had even time for a chat with his supporters from Kenya. So honestly, he didn't seem like someone who has to fear something from the court. And in the courtroom, he didn't behave in an appropriate manner, or he was perfectly in line with the protocol. He didn't speak himself. It was just his attorney. But there was nothing surprising or disturbing.
He was in court as a private individual. Will that help his defense?
Well, let's say he was, of course, his intention was just to appear in as private person, but this doesn't help him really in the case. The case is, there enough evidence or not?
Now, the judges could either send the case to trial or abandon it. When is a decision expected?
Well, now it's of course up to the judges to decide whether they maintain the case or dismiss it, but there is no deadline. It can be a written statement in a couple of days, in a couple of weeks or months, but they will consider very well their decision because, of course, the judges are very much aware of the impact on international law.
So they can either send the case to trial or abandon it. There are no other alternatives. Is that correct?
The two options on the table are the options from the prosecution and from the defense, dropping the charges or maintaining the case, yes.
If the trial against Kenyatta is abandoned, what is likely to be the impact on the court's reputation?
Well, that's perfectly the point where it hurts. This case definitely shows the challenges for international law and its limits. And this is due to the legal status of the court, because The Hague has not its own agents on field. It has not its own investigators in Kenya. So the court's success depends largely on whether the country is willing or failing to cooperate. And now in the specific case, the government and the accused person, this is the same person, so it's Kenyatta. And this is why there is this very complicated deadlock. And of course, the court is aware if they drop the case, what would be the signal? The signal could be that criminals all over the world know if we only stick long enough to non-cooperation, then finally the court will let us go and there won't be international justice. And this could be very difficult for the reputation of the international court. And they are all aware of it, of course.
Katrin Martin in The Hague. Meanwhile, back in Kenya, Kenyatta's deputy, William Ruto, was serving as acting president. As Alfred Kitty reports from Nairobi, his duties included receiving an intelligence briefing and opening a tourism trade fair.
Invited guests, ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to join you today and preside over the launch of a new drive to deliver a key pledge made by the government to the people of Kenya, local and international investors, and other stakeholders. In our manifesto, the Jubilee administration committed itself to transform Kenya into Africa's premier manufacturing and technology hub, as well as the gateway to Africa.
That was William Ruto, the now acting Kenyan president, who assumed the office on Tuesday, carrying state duties that would have otherwise been done by Uhuru Kenyatta. Ruto was accorded all the privileges of a sitting president, including high-level security, from the time Uhuru left for The Hague. President Uhuru Kenyatta, during his State of the Nation address in Parliament on Monday, invoked Section 147(3) of the Constitution of Kenya and appointed his deputy to take charge while he was away.
I now take the extraordinary and unprecedented step of invoking Article 147(3) of the Constitution to appoint Honorable William Ruto, the Deputy President, as Acting President while I attend the Status Conference at The Hague in the Netherlands.
This announcement, however, has elicited a heated political debate after lawyer Mr. Kiprono Matagei immediately went to court on Tuesday and filed an urgent application to the Chief Justice, who is the President of the Supreme Court, to swear in Deputy President William Ruto as President of the Republic of Kenya for the remaining 3 years of Kenyatta's term in office. Kenyans have reacted with varied opinions on this matter. Fred Kamau, a financial advisor based in Nairobi, is an agitated fellow.
He likes disturbing courts for no reason. These lawyers who just like going to the court to show that they are busy. They are busy doing nothing.
Others feel otherwise.
If it's within the Constitution, may it be,
says businessman Michael Njue. Alphonse Tabani, a banker, says the case should be dismissed.
The president is always advised by a very competent legal team, as opposed to what other people would say on the streets. So that one is a wastage of court's time, and I think the case should be dismissed.
The matter, which was classified as urgent, will be heard on Thursday. Since Uhuru Kenyatta left for The Hague as an ordinary citizen, leaving his deputy Ruto in charge, Kenyans have not ceased giving their opinions on whether it was the right thing to do or not.
For as much as he had said it is a personal issue, but it's affecting us because he's the president of Kenya.
I think he's done the wisest thing ever, that let him go there as a private citizen, let him clear his name. If the court feels like he doesn't have anything to pin him down, he can be set free.
I wish that his case be cleared and he comes back home. We continue building the country.
Supporters of Uhuru Kenyatta are hoping that the court will throw out the case once and for good.
Alfred Kitty reporting from Nairobi.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Last month, Israel's High Court ordered that the Israeli government could no longer detain illegal immigrants for up to a year without trial, and ordered the closure of a detention centre in the Negev Desert within 90 days. Some 2,000 Africans are currently being held there. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has already ordered ministers to draft new legislation on immigration. Camilla Schick has been talking to some of the migrants and sent us this report.
This could be the sound of any party in Tel Aviv, but in fact, I'm sitting on a rock in the middle of the Negev Desert in South Israel, close to the border with Egypt, with about 2,000 African asylum seekers who are being held in the government's detention facility known as Holot.
I remember things that I'm not around.
That's Mutassim Ali. He's one of the leaders within the asylum-seeking community in Israel, and he's helping fight for their rights against the indefinite detention. As the sun goes down, the blistering desert air finally cools and the breeze picks up, altogether a reminder that these people have been ordered to live in the middle of nowhere. The detainees tell me that while the food is terrible and the living conditions claustrophobic, they are not treated badly by the guards, nor are they being forcibly deported. But their indefinite detention in the desert and the knowledge that their asylum requests will never be comprehensively processed drives many of them into utter boredom, despair, and ultimately feeling like they have no choice but to take the government's money and leave.
The reason why they just decided to bring us to this place in the middle of the desert and, totally excluded from our side, from society and normal life, is just to make our life difficult and miserable so that we can leave the country.
You come from Darfur in Sudan?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Darfur, and I left Darfur in 2003. The reason I left Darfur is because of the genocide committed by Sudanese government.
Human rights advocates persistently highlight that Israel is a signatory of the UN's convention relating to the status of refugees and stress that people must not be coerced to return to countries where they will face greater persecution just for having set foot in Israel. What did you hear about Israel in Sudan and in Egypt? What did you hear about this place before you came here?
Sometimes even in schools, they teach us really very bad stuff about Israel. Israel is, a hostile state. Israel is not a country that one can go. You cannot go to Israel. According to Sudanese, it's forbidden. It's not allowed at all. Yeah, Sudan considers Israel as a hostile state. Therefore, it's a criminal offense to come to Israel according to Sudanese law. In a Sudanese passport, written that you can go anywhere except Israel. So they teach us really very bad things, not just about Israel, as I said, but also about the people of Israel, especially when we talk about people who are Jewish. And I started to argue and question that. I've never seen them in my life. Why should I have to hate them? And I haven't been to Israel. What's the reason behind this? And more than that, they don't kill me. The government of Sudan is killing me. So why do I have to hate them? That's one of the reasons that...
Mutassim believes that because he was a student activist speaking out against the Sudanese government's actions in Darfur, and because he fled to Israel, he will surely be interrogated and killed if he goes home. There's just under 50,000 African migrants, of which a lot of them are putting forth asylum claims. That's approximately 0.7% of the Israeli population. But the government and the right-wing opinion makers say that, for example, South Tel Aviv is being overrun with, like you say, they call them infiltrators. But it's 0.7% of the population. So what do you want to do to help change Israeli public perception to African migrants who are here, who make approximately 0.7% of the population?
I can understand that Israeli society is scared and afraid of their society, that this country will not be a Jewish any longer. And I just want to say that this is not right and it's not true. We ask for a temporary protection, not forever, and definitely we want to be back to our homes. They shouldn't worry about us being in this country forever. They shouldn't worry about that. They shouldn't worry about more people are coming because now the border is really closed.
What's that?
They're asking guards to go to where the flag is to meet there, I guess, yeah.
Mutassim and the others should be freed from Holot in 90 days, provided the government doesn't come up with another plan to indefinitely detain them through some other means. In the meantime, Mutassim vows not only to continue fighting to secure their rights to asylum, but also to work towards sustainable integration of African migrants within Israeli society.
Camilla Schick reporting, and you can hear an extended version of that report in our programme World Link, which follows Africa Link this coming Friday here on Deutsche Welle.
Behind the headlines.
an unusually high number of people in Nigeria suffer from infertility. One reason is the industrial waste that contaminates the public water supply. Of course, childless couples need practical help most of all, and this can sometimes be given at IVF clinics. One Nigerian woman recently gave birth at the age of 60, and many believe she is the oldest African woman to have a baby. Sam Olukoya takes us behind the headlines.
Hello, miss. 60-year-old Omodara Irure, who is perhaps the oldest African woman to give birth, is the proud mother of this baby. In the last 30 years that she had been married, her search for a baby took her to several hospitals, both at home and abroad. The solution came when she underwent in vitro fertilization, or IVF. This is a high-tech procedure which involves fertilizing a woman's egg and a man's sperm outside the body. Mrs. Irure recalls the moment her doctor told her she was pregnant.
It was a real surprise of the century. I just told the doctor, I said, so God is still there. That was my statement. I said, so God is still there. Are you sure? I asked him that, is he sure what he has just said? They now turned the screen towards me that I should see. I should look at the baby. The baby is fine. The baby is even well developed. I said, what?
So happy are the parents of the baby that they gladly lose their sleep at night to take care of her. Desmond Irure is the baby's father.
I've never tired of looking at her. Anytime she wakes up at night, in fact, I take pleasure. Once she's well fed, if she's full, she will not sleep. And then I put her on my lap, we'll be looking at each other, watching each other. So I enjoy even having a vigil with her.
The fertility problems of the Irures is not an isolated case. Nigeria has an unusually high number of women with fertility problems. British-trained gynecologist Tunde Okewale is head of St. Ivy's Hospital, Lagos, where Mrs. Irure delivered her baby. He said about half of his gynecological consultations have to do with infertility. He attributes the rising cases of fertility problems among Nigerian couples to several factors.
There's been a lot of big social changes in Nigeria as a developing country that tend not to support increasing fertility rates among people. The industry is another thing. People are living next door to industries, you know, and a lot of the industrial waste are getting contaminated with the public water system. So you find a lot of men with low sperm count, etc. You know, so they are quite a combination of many things.
Back at the home of the Ruris, the parents play with their baby. At moments like this, you are sure to find Mrs. Irure singing her favorite song for a newborn daughter.
You are a blessed child. You are a blessed child. Jesus, make you a blessed child. You are a blessed child.
The joys of parenthood, ending that report by Sam Olukoya. A reminder, you're listening to Africa Link, coming to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn, Germany.
Listen to Africa Link where and when you want. Subscribe to our podcast and you will get the latest edition sent to you. Log on to mediacenter.dw.de/English/podcasts and look out for the Africa Link podcast. Africa Link, bringing you the story where and when you want it.
The wife of Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, Grace Mugabe, is carving out a political career for herself. She is now campaigning ahead of a Congress in December, during which high-ranking ZANU-PF party officials will be elected. On Wednesday, Grace Mugabe was speaking at a rally in the City Sports Centre in Harare. I called our correspondent in the Zimbabwean capital, Columbus Mafunga, and asked him what she had been saying.
Grace has been campaigning
calling ZANU-PF senior officials to be united. As you might be aware, ZANU-PF of late has been having two factions, one led by Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa and another one led by Joyce Mujuru, both of them earmarking to succeed President Robert Mugabe.
Which post is Grace Mugabe campaigning for, and what are her chances of being elected?
She's campaigning to be the head of the Women's League of ZANU-PF come December, ZANU-PF Congress. And I think her chances are she will become the next Women's League head of ZANU-PF.
Do people like Grace Mugabe? Can she draw the crowds?
I think as long as President Robert Mugabe is in power, she might be able to draw some crowds. But beyond the era of President Mugabe, I think her chances will be as good as gone.
Can you describe her for us? What's she like?
She's one person who has been riding on luck, if you want. She became the wife of the president when the first wife was still around. And since then, she has been one person we've seen as someone who lacks humility.
Some officials have started addressing her as Your Excellency. What should one read into that?
It's those people who think that one day President Robert Mugabe will anoint her, and those people would want to be seen to be on her side should that happen, and then they would remain seen as her favorites to be part of the cabinet, for example, and also to be part of the ZANU-PF Politburo, which is the decision-making part of ZANU-PF.
President Mugabe is now 90. Does his wife then wish to succeed him one day as president of Zimbabwe?
Yeah, it looks like that's what she's earmarking for, because the other day she was addressing the wives of some pastors, church leaders, telling them that they should look after their husbands should they retire from whatever they will be doing.
But presumably the battle for succession is going to be a very tough one.
For Grace Mugabe, it will be a tight one, especially should the president be out of the matrix of ZANU-PF. ZANU-PF has been running itself as a revolutionary party, and anyone who did not take part in Zimbabwe's liberation war is not seen as someone who can rule ZANU-PF, and one of them is Grace.
Columbus Mavhunga in Harare.
Opinion.
And in Opinion this week, we focus on Kenya's Uhuru Kenyatta, who became the first sitting president to appear before the International Criminal Court. Earlier, we heard from the prosecution, the defense, and a rights activist, among others. Let's listen now to one of the victims of the post-election violence.
Me, what I want to know is it true Uhuru funded the violence? And if yes, it must be prosecuted. If Uhuru was not funding the violence, who was funding the violence? We want to know as Kenyans, because not one person who got injured. And I know so many people are going through that trauma of post-election violence.
So what do you think about the way the ICC is handling the case of Uhuru Kenyatta? That question once again, what do you think of the way the ICC is handling the case of Uhuru Kenyatta? Please let us know your thoughts in a text message to country code 491609575950. An email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to AfricaLink DW 53110 Bonn, Germany.
Get your news faster in the morning. From October 27, AfricaLink will be on air at 4, 5 and 7 UTC. Tune in.
And before we leave you, a reminder of our main stories here on Africa Link. Lawyers for Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta have asked judges at the International Criminal Court to drop the Crimes Against Humanity case against him, saying the prosecution has collapsed. Kenya's deputy, William Ruto, is serving as acting president in his absence. And we've also been hearing about the political ambitions of Grace Mugabe in Zimbabwe. More stories from Africa at the Friday, same time tomorrow. Do join us if you can. As always, thank you for listening. From me, Mark Caldwell. Bye now.